Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm sitting here with Adam Spencer, who has come in to talk about his new books, The Number Games and The 12 Days of Christmas.
Books, awesome. Plural. Yeah. Haven't I been working hard, John? Great to be here, mate.
I'm glad this is a podcast, because last year, or a couple of years ago actually now, we filmed a video of our interview where there is a look of terror on my face as you throw numbers at me. You'll just be able to have to imagine the look of terror on my face now in a podcast.
But I can assure you, it is there.
Let's divide this up a little bit, because you've got The 12 Days of Christmas, which is a gorgeous picture book for kids this Christmas, and also helps them learn a bit of counting. But we've also got a mind-expanding book called The Number Games, which is, you know, it's a book that actually anyone from kids to people getting letters from the Queen can enjoy. Mm. And it will expand all types of minds. Is that right? Even minds like mine who quaver and quiver at the sight of numbers.
Yeah, like all my other books, it's half just bizarre numerical trivia that you don't need a mathematical bone in your body to understand. And there's some really fun, silly stuff in the book. But the other half is mathematics. And I've gone back to my format of going through the numbers 1 to 100. But I thought this time I'd give it a stronger emphasis on puzzles and riddles and things like that, because they've always been really popular parts of the other books I've done. Mm-hmm. Straight out sometimes mathematical equations, but also logic puzzles and things like that. And that was really fun. I've revisited some classic famous puzzles from the history of logic, other ones I discovered for the first time, and I've tried to credit, you know, if there is someone who's known as the creator of them, but also a string of puzzles that I've just come up with myself and a mate of mine from the University of Sydney, Sean Gardiner, who's a brilliant mathematician. We've created a few new categories of number puzzles of our own that we've put in the book that I think people will like and be frustrated by in equal portions.
So if someone sees you sitting in a pub with a couple of beers and you and a mate, you're not talking about the latest footy game, you're creating number puzzles?
Yeah, absolutely. And the great thing is, I like my maths, and I'm pretty handy at maths. Sean is off the charts brilliant, but sometimes struggles to remember that everyone else in the universe isn't like him. So he'll present his first draft of these puzzles, and I'll sit there for a couple of hours and go, look, mate, I got him out eventually, and I quite enjoyed that. We might have to just ease it back a little bit. But what we've done with these, which is really fun, some of these puzzles occur multiple times in the book. And the first time you encounter it at, say, number 22, it's fairly easy and straightforward, and we might even give some pretty big hints. Then you encounter the same sort of puzzle again about the number 45, a couple less hints, a bit harder. And by the third or fourth time in the 80s or 90s that you're encountering these puzzles, they're really pretty solid. And I doubt you would have been able to do them first time round. But having done 10 or 12 examples already, I think there's a bit of a nice gradation to it like that. And I want it to be a book where the answer section, the bit at the back of the book, is just as important as the rest of the book here, because it explains the answers, but also gives you a bit of an insight into the logical way to go about thinking about some of these things. Mm-hmm. A really big part of solving puzzles in maths and in life in general, is to have a good solid strategy in advance that makes sense, will get you to the answer. And half of this is about sort of creating that sort of discipline in the way you think.
So there are a lot of people out there who are busily doing Sudoku puzzles and crosswords and the like to ward off their fears of dementia and Alzheimer's and all these different things. Those are, I wouldn't say lightweights, but they're kind of monotonous, but this one will if you have that in your mind that I do need to do something to keep my mind going in retirement, or in that, this is the book for them as well.
This book keeps you on your toes, and there's a range of different. Some people are really good at arithmetic, and okay, there's three different numbers you've got to add together to give this, and they love just processing that. Other people are really good at thinking about a logic puzzle that might not even have any numbers in it at all. Mm-hmm. We cover the full gamut. Yeah. Of that sort of stuff, but also throwing great bizarre trivia. One of my favourite things in the book we've got here, you know, the high five, yeah. The big slap that everyone does these days when someone doesn't. There's actually a moment in time that we think is the first high five in the history of sport. which I just think is great. And I managed to track it down. And it goes back to a game of baseball on the 2nd of October 1977. The LA Dodgers are playing and against the Astros. And halfway through the match, one of the guys on the Dodgers hits a home run. And that's great. And in doing so, they set this record because they're the first team in history where four guys have hit 30 home runs in a season. This guy creates a little bit of history by hitting that home run. He's running around the bases. His best mate, the team, comes out to greet him at home plate, just sort of punching his fist in the air, and they sort of bump into each other. A few seconds later, that best mate hits his first home run ever in Major League Baseball. And as he's coming around to the home plate, his buddy Dusty comes back out, puts the hand up, they sort of look at each other and slap their hand together. And it was only because they'd done it twice, about a minute apart, it became their thing.
Yeah.
And that little salute, that little celebration is the high five that turns 40 this year.
And with something like that, I mean, you're going out with your research, you plonk it out in a book, and you are actually asking, you're attracting the kinds of people that have minds like yours and like to know the truth, the final thing, and will dig and dig. Are you ready for people to come and go, actually, there was one 15 minutes before that? And
Love it.
Because it's the kind of brain you're asking to look at your book as well. You know?
Absolutely. And I mean, my stuff, it's as authoritative as I can make it.
Yeah.
But I'm always open to someone saying, you know, I think you're fine. And there may well have been people slapping hands before that. Like, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But that's what in inverted commas, universally agreed as. And I love that process of exploration. And sometimes you get really great feedback from people who, in the spirit of a go, I can understand why you've said that, but strictly,
there's a
mammal in the wilds of Borneo that has 27 blah, blah, blah.
And social media is the place for that. And it seems like everything anyone says, there's always someone coming in going, I think that...
But when I say the number 7 is prime, you can take that to the bank.
Yeah. Well, there are some things within this world where we can get to a certain point where we go, that's a fact, Jack, that's back off. Right.
Yeah.
But that, you know, famously, one of the things about science is that scientists aren't dogmatists. They like to be wrong because it excites them, and they go, "Ooh," they get rolling. Are you in that kind of mind frame as well?
Yeah. Science is a process of constantly being open to questions, constantly being open to counter evidence. It's about improving our understanding and homing in on as close to the truth, in inverted commas, as we can get it.
Yeah.
But yeah, scientists very rarely will say to you, this is just the way it is, I refuse to accept anything else. It's that whole process of scientific inquiry. If you can come up with a cogent argument with evidence to suggest that I'm wrong, my scientific mind should be open to that. And there's great stories in here. There's a story in here about one of the greatest, probably, the, you know, nothing universally agreed, the greatest mathematician of all time, made a certain claim about certain types of numbers. And a couple of hundred years later, armed with some seriously heavy computing power, people came out and went, oh, actually, no, he was wrong. And to think that the great Leonard Euler made mistakes is actually beautifully human. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. So we have concentrated so far on the number game, but you are a man of parts, and you have the Adam Spencer's 12 Days of Christmas. Now, this is a gorgeous picture book, a hardcover picture book for kids, for families to sit around and read together. And it's based on the song, the 12 Days of Christmas, right? And but the swans are different.
Yes, exactly. So the last couple of years, I've supplemented the main book with a book aimed at younger audiences. One was called Number Crunchers. One was called The Enormous Book of Numbers. And they took some of the mathematics in my major books that was accessible to younger minds, let's say 6 to 10-year-olds. And this year, we thought, let's go even younger. And because I remember the books that I was reading my kids where they learnt to read and where they learnt stories, and you could see their memory getting a workout of being able to recite a page back to you because you'd read it to them 1,000 times and they hadn't, you know, even if they didn't see it in front of them and things like that. But I was struggling to think of the books I remember as a kid that taught me to count.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm struggling to remember the books I read to my own kids that taught them to count. And I thought, well, Christmas is the perfect time to get a book out that embraces that festive holiday spirit and captures a classic Christmas rhyme and song, but also implicitly just has some counting in it that's not forced down anyone's throat.
Yeah.
And then, having already committed to that, when it turns out there are seven swans, well, they're not just any swans, my friend. They are the mighty Sydney Swans. and if you look at the... so you've got your five gold rings and your three French hens and you get up to after your six geese are laying, seven swans are swimming. And you will notice that one of those swans who's in the tub swimming has a lovely little blonde moustache because my good friend Roy, who did the graphics for the book, doesn't know the Swans as well as I do. And so I'd never heard of Dane Rampey, the superstar All-Australian defender who has this fantastic handlebar moustache. And so after Roy had done his first draft of the book, the only real, editorial control, the only time I stepped in and said, I'm sorry, mate, you've got to change something, I need at least one of the Swans has to have a beautiful blonde moustache. And there you go.
What was it like holding the position in your breakdancing for him to draw you? Because there are some pretty extraordinary pictures of you in this book.
The book's wonderful, isn't it? It's got an image of me and my two daughters, Ellie and Olivia. And the concept is we're hanging around at Christmas and a postman keeps coming, bringing us stuff. And it's the girls going through the process of discovery and receiving the gifts, and they're going to feel pretty happy that they've got images of themselves. And I'm looking a bit slimmer here than I do in real life. So thank you, Roy.
So you got all the images at the end, like you'd done them all, or did you get like there you are?
Yeah.
Nine ladies dancing.
Yeah. This year. So he has a desk in the same office as where I was laying up a lot of the book myself. And so I was looking over his shoulder occasionally and liking what I saw. The images, the pictures are beautiful.
They're great.
And if that gets kids counting and there's detail in here and little sort of references and in-jokes and all that sort of stuff, and then he's got a beautiful thing at the end where all of the French hens and the swans and everything are caught in this one big diagram. And that's got an almost sort of Where's Wally feel. The kids can now look at this page and try and find your seven swans and your six geese. And that, that's a great little... I really like the idea that some kids, this might be the way they learn to count. That feels very good.
And you have a... you have a part of you that seems to want to get... there's a sort of a teacher in you. And going through these books is a great way of reaching far more than just one classroom.
Yeah, I bumped into a lady literally last night at an event who told me her son is now a maths and science teacher. He's just doing his last sort of casual placement before taking his first full-time gig next year. And he made that decision 4 or 5 years ago when he'd seen me speak publicly saying we need more maths and science teachers. And when he was in his first year at university, I think my first book, Big Book of Numbers, came out at the end of that year, and he grabbed a copy of that. Yeah. And that's where he decided he already had a natural aptitude for maths and science, but decided to really pour himself into that. And I just got goosebumps thinking that anything I'd done had made someone choose a really beautiful and noble career, but it got someone else out there who's now going to spend their life talking about science and mathematics to kids.
So you've got your you've got a new podcast.
Yes.
As well. Is this another way of getting that message out?
Yeah, it is. It is. I'm doing something called The Big Questions, available on iTunes and the Podcast One Network, which is me sitting down with people and asking them the big questions. And a lot of it's going to have a sort of science, technology base. I did an interview with Ian Fraser, who's the Australian who invented the Gardasil vaccine that protects girls against HPV and therefore cervical cancer. And the big question to him is, what's it like to save tens of millions of lives? Because his work will literally, over the next century, save the lives of tens of millions of women around the world who won't contract cervical cancer. That's wow. By a beautiful coincidence, the very first one we did on the big question of why do we love sport, and I interviewed Tracy Holmes, ABC sports journalist, and Mick Malloy, yeah. who's a tragic fan of the Richmond Football Club.
Yeah.
And we recorded it when Richmond were making their run towards the grand final, but well before the grand final had been played. And it's still online now, and you can hear the nervous expectation in Mick's voice that maybe, just maybe, but this team has disappointed him so many times, may disappoint him again. And it was just the most ridiculous good luck. You could not jag something better than Mick Malloy in the lead up to the AFL Grand Final saying he hopes Richmond might make the Grand Final, let alone win it. So yeah, that's been really fun. And as you would have, sure, I'm sure, found with this podcast, which I really like listening to, the idea of being able to ask someone follow-up questions and taking your time and not bringing it down to just a soundbite. The sort of stories you can find out about what motivates people to write and the stories they're telling, they need more than 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah, no, I love talking to it. Again, giving the exposure to authors. Yeah. I mean, in this media environment we've got now, there are very few places for there's quite a lot of authors that publish every month to actually get a chance to talk about their career and about what got them where they are.
And it's always interesting for the reader, I find, because I love reading, but it is different to read something if you've ever met the person who's written it or even heard them interviewed or seen any representation of them other than the words you're reading on the page. That sometimes just changes and shades the experience for you. And I think it's great when you hear the motivation of why someone wrote something, then you go and read it.
We see immediately when Richard Feidler interviews someone on radio, the sales come through.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's immediate.
Absolutely. And it gives a more human connection to that person. They're not just the words or letters, or in my case, curious numbers and mathematical symbols on the page.
So what is it that frightens you about a world that where science and maths aren't held in great esteem?
Well, it should frighten all of us, because especially now more than ever with mathematics, and the very simple and slightly cute but I think accurate phrase that I use to explain it is mathematicians will build this century. The digital revolution that's going on means the mathematical arts of big data analysis, statistics, algorithm design, apps, coding will be what lays down the intellectual property of this century. The financial structures of this century, the innovation, will all come through that. You know, people sitting around at the moment trying to break cutting-edge technology in computing and coding and its applications to all sorts of sciences are like a group of Arabs sitting around a century ago trying to invent petrol.
Yeah.
You know, whoever cracks that sort of stuff. There was an Aussie who at the CSIRO who came up with the crucial mathematical structures that underpin Wi-Fi. John Sullivan, CSIRO, when that was finally agreed to by courts around the world, royalties of hundreds of millions of dollars started flowing in to the CSIRO because of the inherent value in that intellectual property he'd created. So mathematics and science in this century will define the world we live in, and we have a choice to be on that bus or miss it and then pay the people on the bus to share in their wisdom.
So things like Trump's attack of fake news and then the authority of journalism and that side of things, breaking down that side. People like Tony Abbott throwing out the ideas of climate science or undermining the actual science, the methods of science themselves, which is more disturbing.
On that point, what's really interesting is that it's interesting the very particular niche areas of science that some people choose to be sceptical about for all sorts of reasons of vested interest or because of the diet of propaganda they've been fed, people feel they have a right to be really sceptical about the integrity and intellectual merit of people who've studied climate science all their life. But if those people, and you wouldn't wish it on them, but if those people went to the doctor and the doctor said, I think your kid's got cancer, not one of those people would say to that doctor or to a specialist, yeah, don't give me your elitist, I've spent all my life studying childhood cancers so I know more about childhood cancer than you rubbish, pal. Mm. Yeah, get off your soapbox. Yeah, who's paying you to say that, mate? What makes you think you'd know just because you've been a pediatric oncologist for 30 years? You know, no one's going to question that. But when it comes to climate science or sometimes vaccinations or things like that, these people are just open season. That makes no sense at all.
Especially when they do their research on their smartphone.
Yeah.
Which wouldn't be around without the same kind of methods that got the answers for vaccination, got the answers for climate science.
And your phone only works. Your phone can only give you GPS and Google Maps and things like that because of an understanding of Einstein's theory of relativity. You know, understanding that the difference in relative movement of the satellites up there to us down here, that's E equals MC squared and all that sort of stuff. It's beautiful. It's embedded. And it's an interesting time. I have people talk to me about this sort of stuff all the time and sometimes people ask, well, your science, it can't explain everything, can it? No, I can't. I've not suggested it can. Well, there you go. But in the example of physics, I always like to say it was 1932. A guy called Chadwick discovers the neutron. And at that stage, we have our basic model of an atom, the stuff that you and I were taught in high school.
Yeah.
Electrons, protons, neutrons. The protons and neutrons hanging in the centre, the electrons whizzing around the other. Now, we sort of understood that structure of an atom back in 1932. They were the three fundamental particles we knew: electron, proton, neutron. 2017, 85 years later, just one human lifetime later, we've gone from three fundamental particles to 61.
Yeah.
Right, that's a 20-fold increase in our understanding of one of the most basic questions that all humans, ever since whatever you want to call human, has been able to do whatever you want to call thinking. So that could be a couple of 100,000 years. Can be 2 million, however you want to call it. People, in inverted commas, have wondered, what is stuff? What's that made of? Why is that like that? And that the stuff on black, that's different. What is stuff?
Yeah.
And we've had a concept of atomism or atoms for a couple of thousand years. So for a couple of thousand years, we've tried to work out what stuff is. It took us those 2,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 years to come up with three particles.
Yeah.
In the last 85 years, we've come up with another 58.
Hmm.
So no, physics can't explain everything at the moment, and physics will never be able to explain everything. But now is not the time to get off the physics bus.
No.
Physics is gone. Don't drop physics from the team. Physics is batting all right at the moment. Keep sending physics in at number three. The openers are a bit shaky. We need a spinner, but physics is seeing them pretty well at the moment.
Adam, it's been delightful talking to you. And it wasn't as scary as the last time, so I've sort of relaxed a little bit.
I love this. This is a great puzzle. No offense, you won't get it.
Oh, good.
But it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. So, evil genius.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at them.
Takes you prisoner, walks you into her lair, and in there's a giant pile of gold coins on a table. Too many to count. Hundreds, thousands. They're all facing tails, except for exactly 20 of them that show heads. She blindfolds you and shuffles the coins around. You don't know which are where on the table. You can't tell by feeling them or anything like that. So you just know in front of you there's a giant amount of coins. Exactly 20 of them show heads. She says, all you've got to do is just pull some of these coins across into a pile. So you've made two piles. And as long as there's the same number of heads in both piles, I'll let you go free. You can take all the coins. Otherwise, I'll kill you. Make your two piles with those. You can turn those coins over or keep them as they are. Do whatever you want. You can't in any way tell what they are. So, what do you do?
I try to find your home address on Google.
and
knock on the door.
And this is the beautiful thing. Now, if there's an unlimited number of coins on the table, it could be 100, it could be 200, whatever. The only number you've been given in the question is 20. So the if there is an answer, you initially think there's no answer, I can't possibly. The answer must have something to do with 20.
Yep.
Because it's the only number you've been given. So focus on 20. Okay, well, that's the most obvious thing to do is, okay, let's take 20 coins away. Now, it might end up in some puzzles, maybe it ends up being 10, because that's half of 20 or 4. It's got to have something to do with it. If I took 20 coins away, I've got no idea how many heads I've taken over there, do I? Let's say I've taken exactly 3 heads into my 20.
Mm-hmm.
How many heads are left in the big pile?
Well, you hopefully there'll be 17.
There are 17. There's 3 over here in my 20. So I've got 3 heads and 17 tails in my 20, haven't I?
Mm-hmm.
How could I turn those coins into exactly 17 heads and 3 tails? Flip all 20 of them over. Do you see?
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
Now, let's say if I hadn't taken across 3 heads, say I'd taken across 6 heads initially. I'd have 6 heads and 14 tails over here. How many heads in the original pile?
Same.
14. Same. If I flipped them all, however many heads, even let's and you always check the outliers. Let's say I took 0 heads across.
Mm-hmm.
Still got 20 heads in the original pile. I've got 20 tails over here. If I flip them all over, I've got, that's the... What a beautiful answer.
That is
what a beautiful question.
Yeah.
Take them all over. Take any 20 you want, flip them all, and you're guaranteed to walk away. And it shows you that there is an answer to when you first hear that, you go, there is... I can't tell because I don't know how many.
Yeah.
But the fact that the question's been posited, and part of the strength of this book is it makes you think, okay, let's not freak out here. You've been asked a question. There must be an answer. What have we got? This is the only info we do. Let's try and work on that.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you very much for coming in and talking to us. And we hope you present more next year. Is that something on the cards that we can look forward to?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I mean, I feel that there's much more maths to tell.
Yeah.
As long as there's an appetite for it, I'll keep them coming.
Well, there is an appetite. We're already selling this one.
Superb.
For these books, actually.
I believe at booktopia.com.au.
Yes, that's where you'll find them.
Well, there you go.
You can get all of
what are the
books
odds?
At booktopia.com.au. Thank you very much, Anne.
Pleasure, mate.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.